Morning, Oregon, and happy hump day. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the show. In today's podcast, we have a special treat. It's part one of a three-part presentation of a story I wrote back in 2009. It wasn't initially a story for Offbeat Oregon. It was a magazine article for Etude, the magazine of literary nonfiction, which was edited by Dr. Lauren Kessler, my lead professor at the University of Oregon, where I was at the time a graduate student, working toward a master's degree in literary nonfiction. By the way, if you're not familiar with Dr. Kessler, well, she's the author of Stubborn Twig, Clever Girl, and Happy Bottom Writing Club, along with about 10 other books. The three I named are among my favorite books by any author, especially Happy Bottom Writing Club, which is about pioneer aviatrix Pancho Barnes. So publishing an aviation story in her magazine was a little daunting because it was very much in her wheelhouse. I made sure to bring my A game. And if I could just brag a little bit, I kind of did. Until at least 2015, possibly later, I still considered this article the best writing I had ever done. I still think it holds up pretty well, unlike almost everything else I wrote back then, you know. Turns out when you spend 15, 20 years writing local history stories every week, you learn a few techniques here and there along the way. At some point, I suppose I should rewrite this, but I almost consider it a historical artifact at this point. In any case, here it is, warts and all. Except for one or two warts that Dr. Kessler ordered me to remove before it was published. As I recall, at one point I compared the sound of the H-1 flying overhead to a gang of Hell's Angels doing contract work for Santa Claus, only it was July. Do you know, if an editor rolls her eyes hard enough, it actually makes an audible sound? I do. I found an earlier edition and added that line back in, though, mostly just because I'm hoping Dr. Kessler will see it and roll her eyes again. Anyway, there's one last thing I want to say before I start this article, and that's this. Get your calendar out and schedule a visit to the Oregon Aviation Historical Museum, located at Jim Wright Field, aka the Cottage Grove State Airport. I'll talk more about the museum later, but I wanted to get that full-throated recommendation in now. You will not regret it. All right, I've yammered on long enough. Let's get to the story of Jim Wright and his astounding airplane. It's based on a story that was first published on March 11th of 2009. Jim Wright was just trying to get over the Rockies and make it home. To get him there, he was depending on a machine that looked as if it belonged in an aviation museum, and in fact the only other one like it was in the Smithsonian and hadn't flown since 1937. That other one had been built by Howard Hughes in 1934 to set a new speed record, a new world speed record, and he did the following year. He then tucked it away in a dusty hangar where it remained for the rest of Hughes' life. Wright built the other one in 2002. Now, a little over a year later, it was a beautiful, clear day and he was soaring over the Rocky Mountains in it. Wright was flying back home to Cottage Grove, Oregon, from the legendary annual air show at Oshkosh, Wisconsin. There, as everywhere else he'd brought his airplane, it had been the toast of the event, a perfect replica of one of the most important planes in history with a one-digit serial number, 2. Airplane enthusiasts and history buffs alike had found the replica to be like a time machine. Everything on it, they'd noted, was either custom-made or a restored original component from the early 1930s. The enormous round engine, the cockpit controls, even the twin-blade Hamilton Standard constant-speed propeller hub that had been modified in exactly the same way Hughes had been to complement the plane's 1,000-horsepower engine. It was that insistence on authenticity that would, that day, destroy his priceless aircraft and make a widow of Betty, his wife. I first met Jim Wright in 2002, when he was putting the finishing touches on the plane, the H-1 Racer. At the time, I was the editor of his hometown newspaper, the weekly Cottage Grove Sentinel. A tiny town at the very southern tip of the Willamette Valley with farmland to the north and timberlands to the south, Cottage Grove has a correspondingly small newspaper. There were three of us in the newsroom, me, reporter Matthew Treader, and photographer Jared Pabin. Technically, it was Treader's story, but naturally, we were all very interested. A major nationwide sensation was brewing up right in our own backyard. and it was no exaggeration to call the H-1 that. It was an astonishing piece of industrial art, a shining silver tube of polished aluminum with electric blue wings sitting on a tall, spindly landing gear, the cockpit pushed way back toward the tail. Sitting there on the tarmac with that massive, blunt engine thrust up into the air, it had an austere, uninviting, all-business look, like an unmanned missile with a propeller on the front. In the air, though, with the landing gear up and the fuselage level, it looked like a different airplane. In the spirit of the very finest industrial sculpture of the Art Deco 1930s. Sleek, streamlined, fabulous. Yet it was not designed with looks in mind. The H-1's beauty was strictly incidental to its real purpose. The long liquid lines in gleaming polished aluminum weren't there to be admired. They were there to slip the air past faster so that an extra 2 miles per hour could be squeezed from it. The engine was round because that was the shape of the most powerful engine available at the time. The wing lines flowed out from the fuselage not for looks, but so that the wings could carry the structural load, saving a few dozen pounds. Just sitting there on the ground, pointing skyward at a 30-degree angle, it was an irrefutable demonstration that beauty and function live in the same place and may even be married to each other. Wright himself was as quiet and unassuming as his airplane was striking and noticeable. A self-taught engineer who'd never bothered to go to college, Wright was mechanically a natural, having started out working on lawnmowers at a very young age. "He was a real smart, real affable guy," Treader remembered later, "generous with his time." Treader, who interviewed Wright several times for stories, called the aviator a natural-born storyteller. He was half of the husband and wife team that started Wright Machine Tools in 1976. During the 25 years that followed, they built it into a lucrative business that still exists today, producing machines that sharpen and maintain industrial carbide saws, among other things. By the late 1990s, it had become the kind of business that quietly overshadows the place in which it's located. It may have occupied an unassuming beige building on the outskirts of a tiny Oregon town, but it was a multi-million-dollar enterprise. Throughout the time from the founding of the company to the building of the H-1, Wright himself didn't change much. Most of the time, his face wore one of two expressions, a huge open grin or a focused look of intense concentration. Though he liked himself just fine and loved exotic toys, he showed no signs of the kind of egoism that one expects from someone so successful. His office was modest, a bit cramped, dusty, stocked largely with cheap but serviceable furniture made of particle board covered with vinyl printed to look like oak. The computers there had originally been beige but had turned yellow with age. Wright's desk faced the wall, making his office look like a workstation rather than a command center. And through a window in that wall, Wright could look out at the airport and watch planes come and go. It was no coincidence that his business was located right next to the little community airport. Wright's father was an aviator and had passed the bug on to his boy. Wright bought his first plane, a Taylor craft that he still owned, when he was just 21 years old. As his business grew, Wright started acquiring more fast, exotic things. A rare Honda CBX six-cylinder motorcycle from the early 1980s, a red Corvette that he used for his regular driving, even a street-legal Formula race car that he drove around on special occasions. That last one was a gift from Betty. On the airfield outside the shop was parked an early 1950s Beechcraft Bonanza, one of those V-tailed hot rods of the sky like the one that Richie Valens and Buddy Holly crashed in. In his hangar, he kept a Glass Air 3, a sleek, kit-built plane that flew 2.5 times faster than an entry-level Cessna. But the Hughes Racer, that was to be the highlight, the crown jewel in his hangar. He'd dreamed of building this plane since 1978 when he read about it in a magazine article from the 30s, and he'd been fascinated by the Hughes plane since he was young. Its blinding speed, its secretive inventor who hurried to hide it from the world after breaking the second speed record with it in 1937, and the persistent rumors, given extra weight by Hughes himself, that its design had been sold or leaked to Japan and had inspired the dreaded Type Zero fighter from World War II. By the late 1990s, Wright's business was successful enough that he was able to pursue that dream. We'll talk about how he went about pursuing it tomorrow in part 2 of this 3-part presentation of the Jim Wright story. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. And by the way, if you like this kind of stuff, you might be interested in my other podcast. It's called the Penny Dreadful Hour podcast, and it's basically an early Victorian variety show. Each week, I read a chapter or two from several different classic Penny Dreadful story papers published between 1840 and 1866 or so, complete with historical and sociological commentary sometimes, and definitions of the flash-cant slang lingo that was used by Romany family coves, bold highway robbers, and titled Regency roisterers back in the day. Check it out. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts, or you can cut straight to it at pennydread.com/apple or pennydread.com/spotify. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Fresh episodes of Offbeat Oregon History come your way at around 6 a.m. every weekday morning, so if you're looking for the next one, you haven't got long to wait. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.